Okay, we will call Property Tax Division, March 15th meeting to order. We will note that quorum is present and we can conduct lawful business. First on the agenda, we have to approve two sets of minutes. First, March 3rd. Do I have a motion? Vice Chair Lee, have you had a chance to go over?
Diligently, and I move to approve the minutes from March 3rd.
Okay, for March 3rd, any discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Now on to March 8th. Vice Chair Lee?
I move to approve the minutes from March 8th.
Any discussion? Hearing none. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Okay, first on the agenda, House File 2725. Chair moves that House File 2725 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Property Tax Division report. Welcome, Representative Norris, and to your bill.
Thank you, Chair Liz Lagarde and members. It's great to be with you here in the Property Tax Committee. Members, if you're like me, I'm sure one of the main concerns you've been hearing from your constituents lately is the cost of rising property taxes. And in particular, I'm hearing this from our seniors who are, you know, trying to stay in their homes. But as valuations go up, they're seeing their property tax bill go higher and higher. And I want to give Chair Liz Lagarde a lot of credit. I know you've really made this a laser focus for you this year, trying to offer some property tax relief. And I think this brings one additional tool to the table. And this is really supercharging the property tax refund for homesteads. What it does is it's designed to give some homeowners relief if they see a big jump in their property tax bill from one year to the next. So currently, under state law, if their property tax bill jumps by more than 12% from year to year, they're eligible to get a special refund. And right now, under state law, that refund is up to $1,000. But as I said, what we want to do is really supercharge that. So we're going to give some short-term relief and then also kind of adjust it moving forward. So we know since people are really feeling the pinch right now, what we're going to do in 2023 is we're going to say instead of 12%, if your property tax bill increases by more than 6%, you're going to be eligible for this refund. And we're going to increase the amount you're eligible for from a maximum of $1,000 to a maximum of $2,500. So really expanding the number of people who are eligible and also the amount of the refund that they're eligible to receive. And then starting in 2024, we're going to drop that threshold from 12% to qualify to 8%. And you'd be eligible for a maximum refund of $2,000. So, again, designed to really target those folks who are feeling the pain the most from the rising property tax bills in getting them some much-needed relief. And with that, Chair Liz Lagarde, I know I've got a couple of testifiers for the bill.
Well, thank you, Representative Norris. I think first up we have Nathan Jessen. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the Property Tax Division, my name is Nathan Jessen. I represent the League of Minnesota Cities. I know that the division previously heard a few property tax refund proposals, but like Representative Norris said, he did a great job summarizing the proposal. This is really a supercharge, going to amp it up for a couple of years. And I think that approach really makes sense now, especially not only given the surplus that the state has, but the high level of inflation that impacted city levies combined with the rising residential valuations on homeowners, that right now in particular is a good time to consider a proposal like House File 2725. It's also really important to look at proposals like this because they're not going to result into shifts onto other types of properties, be they other residential properties or non-residential properties, right? A lot of proposals come forward that may consider that approach, but this avoids any shifts onto other properties, so we think it's a strong proposal.
Thank you. Next up, we have Paul Eager. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Paul Eager, and I'm Senior Vice President of Governmental Affairs for the Minnesota Realtors Association. We are a statewide business trade association with over 22,000 members working with buyers and sellers of all types of property in every corner of the state. Just want to thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of Representative Norris's HF 2725 Thank you, Representative Norris, for bringing the bill forward. When you have an author that explains the bill as well as Representative Norris did, as well as Mr. Jessen's testimony in front of you, it'll give me the ability to be very brief today. We also concur with the comments that you've heard from Representative Norris and Mr. Jessen. This is a good time for this proposal. We continue to see a challenging housing market that has certainly cooled off as a result of the interest rate hikes and inflation over the past year plus. However, we also continue to have a lack of housing inventory to meet demand, which puts upward pressure on valuations, which is what you all are seeing in your districts statewide. So this bill would provide some much needed relief for homeowners and just to emphasize the point that Mr. Jessen mentioned. Also, this also has the benefit of not shifting property tax burden from one type of property onto others. So it has a number of different benefits. And thank you for hearing the bill, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Norris.
Thank you. Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, Member Discussion. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I understand the reasoning and support the reasoning to prevent and or mitigate the big bumps. I just would hope that the committee would hear other bills that would address that. 2244 would do a five-year rolling average to smooth out any one-year blips. Anyone that maybe needs some of these other ones that, you know, are more costly, shall we say, to implement because you're having to do the filing and go through the paperwork, and ways that are less burdensome to the taxpayers. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Mr. Chair, sorry about that. Question for the bill author, and yeah, I support your bill as well. Just wondering if we're talking about the total tax bill in its entirety, what if there are special assessments added on from one year to the next, or a school levy addition, how would that impact your bill in its entirety?
Representative Norris.
Yeah. Chair Lissagard, I'm wondering if that's a question that we could maybe toss to nonpartisan staff to talk about the interactions between those different components of a property tax bill that a resident receives.
Mr. Swanson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, so the property tax is payable that is used for the determination of property tax refunds is sort of net property taxes after any applicable credits. So it wouldn't include special assessments, and it would be the net amount after any credits are applied.
Mr. Anderson. Anyone else? Closing comments.
All right. Thank you, Chair Lissagard. And again, thank the committee for hearing the bill. I think a really good point that some of the testifiers made, too, is this is a way we can help address property tax increases without shifting the burden to other property taxpayers. And with our surplus that we've got, I think we should be putting some money back in the pockets of Minnesotans, and this bill is a great way to do it.
Thank you. And you're right, Representative Norris, it is a supercharged. So the chair renews his motion that House File 2725 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Property Tax Division report. Okay. So next, I will turn the gavel over.
The chair moves that House File 2012 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Property Tax Division report. Is that your motion, Mr. Chair?
So moved, Madam Chair.
I understand there's an author's amendment to get the bill in the form that you'd prefer. It's the DE2 amendment in member packets.
Yes, I will make that motion to get the bill in the proper order.
Okay. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The amendment is adopted, and House File 2012 is amended with the DE2 amendment.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. It is an honor for me to present House File 2012 as amended today. This bill modifies the distribution of taconite production tax, which is in lieu of property tax, to county schools, cities within the taconite assistance area. And before we begin, if I may, Madam Chair, I would like Mr. Swanson to walk through the bill, and then I will turn it over to my testifiers.
Great, thank you. Mr. Swanson, please walk us through House File 2012 as amended.
Madam Chair and members, I'm going to walk through the DE amendment to House File 2012. I'll just go section by section. A few of these are just conforming changes, and they'll be pretty brief. So Section 1 of the bill is just a conforming change related to Section 4. Section 2 of the bill changes the definition of the taconite assistance area, and this is just a geographical definition that determines a few things related to mining-related taxes. One of the primary purposes of the area is it sort of defines where some of the mining taxes get distributed. So Section 2 would expand the definition or expand the area, geographical area that's included in the taconite assistance area. So the boundaries for this area are based on school districts. So this would add school districts that contain a municipality that meets two different criteria. And the first one of those is that the county is already partially included in the taconite assistance area. And then the second criteria is that there needs to be active mining of non-ferrous or non-iron-bearing material. Section 3 is another conforming change related to Section 4. And Section 4 is a change related to the net proceeds tax. And there are three different changes under this section that I'll walk through. But maybe first just a little bit of background. The net proceeds tax is the in lieu of property tax for non-ferrous mining. So the taconite industry pays a production tax in lieu of property taxes. The net proceeds tax is that sort of similar in lieu property tax for the mining of non-iron-bearing materials. Currently, this tax has never generated any revenue, but once there's non-ferrous mining occurring in the state, this will begin to generate revenue. So the three changes to the net proceeds tax, again in Section 4, the first change is that the net proceeds tax is changed from a tax on net proceeds to a tax on gross proceeds. And the difference here is that under current law, the net proceeds tax allows for a number of deductions related to the processing of the materials that are actually mined. This would get rid of those deductions and expand the tax base so that the tax is applied to the gross proceeds of the mining operations rather than the net. And then a corresponding change, you can see this in subdivision one of that section, a corresponding change related to that tax base expansion is a reduction of the overall tax rate. So current law is this tax is a 2% tax on net proceeds. Subdivisions 1 and 2 of Section 4 would make that a 0.4% tax on gross proceeds. Lastly, in Section 4, Subdivision 3 creates a new minimum payment under this tax. So what Subdivision 3 would do is it says, you know, once a mine actually has secured all of its permits and is ready to start mining, they'd be subject to a minimum payment of $2 million unless they actually started, you know, pulling material out of the ground and paying the gross proceeds tax. Section 5 is another change related to this tax. So I'm going to refer to it as the gross proceeds tax because that's what the bill would change it to. But this might be easier to walk through using the House Research Bill Summary. So there's a table for Section 5, and it's sort of easier to see the changes there. So the first row in the table would make a change to how the 5% distribution of the gross proceeds tax would be distributed. So under current law, that 5% would go to the city or town where the mining or processing occurs. Under the bill, that would continue to be the case unless a mine is located in the Mesabi East School District. If that was the case, then this 5% would be shared between the cities of Aurora, Babbitt, Ely, Hoyt Lakes, Bowabic, and Embarrass Township. The next change in Section 5 to the gross proceeds tax distribution is a few lines down on the table, and it's the county distribution. So under current law, the county where the mine is located would receive 20% of the gross proceeds tax. This bill would change that to 10% of the distribution. The next line in the table is the distribution to the property tax relief account. Under current law, that account would receive 20% of the distribution, and this bill would change that to 5%. The next row in the table changes the Iron Range Resources and Rehabilitation distribution. Under current law, that's 5%. The bill would change that to 20%. And then lastly, the final line of the table shows that the bill would add a new 10% distribution of the gross proceeds tax to the commissioner of the commissioner of the Iron Range Resources and Rehabilitation for capital improvements to Giants Ridge. One more change in Section 5 is that this section would state that for the first 5 years that any mining company is paying the gross proceeds tax, 10% of the total distribution would get distributed again to those cities that are in the first row of the table. So it would go to the cities of Aurora, Babbitt, Ely, Hoyt Lakes, Bowabic, and Embarrass Township. And again, that's just for the first 5 years that there's a distribution under this tax. The remaining 90% would flow through, as you see in the table. After those first 5 years, then 100% of the gross proceeds tax would be distributed, as you see in the table for Section 5. Section 6 of the bill is another conforming change related to Section 4. Section 7 and 8 are both production tax-related provisions, and they sort of go together. So under current law, in 2024, there's set to be a change in the distribution of the production tax. Under current law, the distribution to the Iron Range School Consolidation and Cooperatively Operated School Account is set to be reduced by 5 cents per taxable ton, and that 5 cents is set to flow into the county distribution. So there's sort of the simultaneous reduction in the school account and a corresponding increase in the county distribution. What Section 7 and 8 would do is sort of prevent that from happening, so the distributions to both of those accounts would stay the same as they currently are. Section 9 is another conforming change related to Section 4. And finally, Section 10 is another production tax-related provision. So this would provide a one-time transfer of any excess from the property tax relief account to the IRRR account, up to $6 million. Again, this is just a one-time transfer. If there's any excess in that account, it would transfer that from the relief account into the IRRR's account. And Madam Chair, that concludes the overview.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Swanson. Now I will move it back to Mr. Chair. I understand you have two witnesses with you today. I guess we'll start with Mr. Royce Smith first. Please state your name and your organization for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Roy Smith. I am the Director of Education and Talent Development for the Department of Iron Range Resources and Rehabilitation and Minnesota State Colleges and Universities.
You may please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, probably one thing we all have in common today is that we came here from places where we live, and we probably live not too far from a public school. We all understand the importance of strong schools for our communities, for our students, for our teachers, and for the business and industries in our communities that depend on those students for their future workforce. Great schools make our communities great places to live. We also understand, however, that there are challenges to operating those schools, from finding qualified instructors to maintenance and operating issues to offering challenging curriculum for our students and for our teachers to help develop their careers. These challenges are no different within the taconite assistance area, an area of northeastern Minnesota about the size of Maryland that is served in the districts and the students that live in that area. In order to help our districts address these issues, in 2014, the Minnesota legislature enacted Minnesota Statute 298-28 Subdivision 7A, the Iron Range School Consolidation and Cooperatively Operated School Account, commonly known as the school account. The school account was established to provide the agency with funds to help school districts located in northeastern Minnesota with bond payments for projects or programs that resulted in school district collaboration or consolidations and improved curricular opportunities for students and teachers. To date, the IRRB has approved 14 school account expenditures impacting all four school districts in northeastern Minnesota.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Smith. Next, we have Whitney Ridlin. Please state your name and your organization for the record.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. My name is Whitney Ridlon, and I work at the Department of Iron Range Resources and Rehabilitation as a community development representative, and I administer the school account funding. Today, I am here to provide some information on the projects that the school account actually funds. Five of these 14 projects require ongoing agency payment for school bonds. These five projects were voted on and passed by voter referendum and are included and include significant community investment from our local communities. Projects have focused on modernizing and right-sizing the educational system in northeastern Minnesota. The first project I want to provide is the consolidation of the Virginia, Eveleth, and Gilbert school districts. This was a historic consolidation of three school districts. They worked together to develop a K-12 state-of-the-art career-focused school. We are training our students at the new Rock Ridge High School in partnership with our local employers to be better prepared for the workforce. Another example of a collaborative project that we've assisted is the expanding of career and technical training into the Cook County and Aiken school districts by modernizing equipment and learning space to provide for increased technical education. We've also helped fund the West Range Career Pathways Program, which is a partnership with 8 Itasca County school districts to provide customized career pathways with local businesses in the areas of automotive, business, computer science, construction, education, healthcare, manufacturing, natural resources, and agriculture. One more project. We also have provided curriculum shared by multiple school districts to offer unique classes that aren't offered in northeastern Minnesota, like Mandarin Chinese. In 2024, a portion of these taconite dollars equal to 5 cents that are now dedicated to the school account will expire. If we don't remedy this, the school account's balance may be insufficient to meet obligations and the burden will go on to our communities. This proposal would maintain the allocation of the 5 cents of taconite tax that will expire and remain in our communities, in our schools, to help our children with the education that they need and that our businesses need in the long run. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Ms. Ridlon. Are there members of the public who'd wish to testify on this bill? Okay, seeing none, we will move to member discussion. All right. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm not really sure who to direct this question to, but in the revenue note for this bill, on page 3 in the very top, I'll just read what it says here. It says, it is assumed the new range copper nickel will obtain all necessary permits in 25 and begin production in 26. And is there anyone from the Department of Revenue or any testifiers who can provide us some documentary evidence to back this up? This is a project that's been in permitting for how many years, Representative Lislegard?
Representative Garofalo. Well, so if you have a question about this, let's see if the chair could, has a response, and then we can see if the department is here.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to Representative Garofalo, you are right. It has been a very, very long time. This bill is designed for nothing to kick in until all permits are granted and valid. That means that they have went through the process of being litigated and they can move forward. So nothing moves forward. So I don't know what documentation necessarily you're referring to, but they did receive their permits and they are being litigated. I think that they have won, every challenge to this point, and I believe that they are narrowing it down to a very few. So we're all very hopeful.
Yeah, thank you. So, Madam Chair, I guess when I referenced Representative Lislegard, it was the secondary question of how long this has been in permitting for. I think the number is 18 years. 18 years. Okay. And so when we see from the Department of Revenue, it says it is assumed the New Range Copper Nickel will obtain all necessary permits in 25 and begin production in 26. It would just, I'd like to know what assumptions from the Department of Revenue, if there's anyone available here, to provide us what data they're basing that off of, because from this legislator's corner of the world who's watched this process drag on for 18 years, there is not only little, there is no data to back up that this project is going to be allowed to go forward by with production in 26. If there's no one from the Department of Revenue, then that's just a statement, not a question.
Representative Garofalo, so, I mean, revenue notes are based on modeling from the department, but I think let's see if there's someone from the department who can answer this question. Please state your name and your organization for the record.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Joanna Bears. I'm the legislative director of the Department of Revenue. Madam Chair and Representative Garofalo, that's a good question. Our property tax folks put that together, our property tax research team, and so I will go back and get those assumptions and get that to you.
And Madam Chair, if I could just ask the department, whenever that response is, just please send it to the chair, staff, and all members of the committee. There's no reason just to limit the response to me. If there's good news out there that I don't know about, I'm happy to hear it. So thank you very much. I appreciate the response.
Sure. Representative Garofalo, we will share anything we get from the department. Thank you. Is there further discussion on the bill? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just curious about the change from a gross tax to a net type of tax. To the bill author, Chair Lislegarde, is this going to be pretty much a wash in terms of the amount collected, or why the change?
Chair Lislegarde.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to Representative Anderson. Yes, going from a 2% net to a 0.4 gross is going to be a net over the duration of the permit that is before us.
Great, thank you. Oh, and lead Quam to wrap things up, unless anyone else has any other questions. Great.
Thank you. I assume you meant it would be a break even, not a net. This basically is just saying, if they ever get allowed to mine, non-ferrous is going to have a minimum of $2 million assessed against them. I'm trying to understand, is that $2 million based off of projected possible annual revenues, or, you know, where's that pulled out of?
Chair Lislegarde.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to lead Quam. So how this kind of typically unfolded is that won't be the ultimate when they are in production. That is a minimum stating that as soon as those permits are valid, they have went through the process, met or exceeded both state and federal standards, they were issued, and then obviously what we have seen in past is that they're going to be litigated or challenged, and then once they go through that process and those permits can move forward and they can begin, that is when that minimum payment will kick in. And then once they start production, then it would be increased. And to your question earlier, it would be net neutral, meaning that from net 2% to 0.4 gross, it's net neutral over that period. That was a good catch.
Great, thank you, Chair Lislegarde. And I think non-president staff also wants to add.
Madam Chair, Chair Lislegarde, and lead Quam. Also, if you take a look at the revenue estimate on page 3, the same page that Representative Garofalo drew your attention to, the fifth bullet point talks about when production is actually expected, and that the gross proceed tax would yield $4 million beginning in fiscal 2028, and that is outside of the forecast window. So what you see in the revenue estimate for 26 and 27, that $2 million is the minimum amount that Mr. Swanson referred to when he explained the bill.
Great, thank you. Chair Lislegarde, closing words.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. You know, obviously taxes is complex, and the Iron Range is no different than that. But, you know, these programs and this bill moving forward is going to improve the lives of the people of Northeast Minnesota, and I would greatly appreciate any support that I could moving forward. Thank you.
Great. The chair renews his motion that House File 2012, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in the Property Tax Division report. The bill, as amended, is laid over.
Okay, give me that big stick there. There we go. All right. It's only property, you know, chair stick. No, it ain't the big chair. Anyway, House File 2495, Representative Lee moves that House File 2495 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Property Tax Division report to your bill.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Colleagues, thank you for hearing House Bill 2495 today. It's a simple bill that would allow Ramsey County to apply a uniform period of time for property tax repayment on all properties at 3 years. In case folks don't know, currently there are properties in St. Paul that have a redemption timeline of only, or time limit of only 1 year. And while this policy was set up with the intention of minimizing the impact of out-of-town speculators that wouldn't pay their property taxes for 3 years, the unexpected impact of this was to push properties in these targeted communities faster into forfeiture. And so for us, this is an equity issue that I hope the division will help our city fix. And with that, I want to pass it to my witness today, Commissioner Rena Moran.
Well, it's an honor to welcome Commissioner Moran to our committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Well, good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Rena Moran, Ramsey County Commissioner, District 4. It is so good to see you guys. So a little background. In the late 80s, St. Paul established policies and procedures for the allocation of urban revitalization action program funds, including procedures to identify neighborhoods having higher unemployment, lower medium income, household income, and a greater proportion of substandard housing that the city as a whole saw through their lens. The city established target neighborhoods as meeting certain eligibility requirements. Pursuant to Minnesota Statute 281.17b, the statutory redemption period for all land not defined as homesteaded land located in these target communities could be accelerated from 3 years to 1 year and tax forfeited to the state of Minnesota for non-payment of property taxes. But at the time, policies to aid neighborhood revitalization were initially adopted, and thereafter one of the city goals was to reduce the negative impact of tax delinquent and tax forfeited lands within the targeted communities through the utilization of the accelerated tax redemption period. The city now finds that the concerns regarding properties having delinquent taxes or tax forfeited status shifted and has now been replaced by concerns that the active real estate market is now displacing the current residents of targeted communities. Based upon these new concerns, the City Council found the policy to accelerate the forfeitures and sales of tax delinquent properties within these communities pursuit is no longer the solution within these communities. So what happened, the problem was that the St. Paul took action in 2022 to no longer participate in the targeted community revitalization program. This change will first apply to properties starting in tax payable year 2024. These properties will have 3 years instead of one to pay any back taxes owned. This change does not apply to taxes that have already been included on a tax statement payable year 2022, or where the assessment year has already commenced, payable year 2023. The redemption period was already determined for these years, and statute does not allow to be changed once determined. This means non-homestead properties in this once designated targeted community would still be treated differently than other properties across Ramsey County. They would still only have 1 year to pay back their property taxes. So what we would like you to do is we would like to pursue this legislation allowing us to apply the three-year redemption period instead of the one-year redemption period to properties located in targeted communities in 2023 and forward. This legislation will allow all properties across Ramsey County to have the three-year redemption period uniformly applied beginning in 2023, thereby eliminating the disparities caused by the statutory accelerated forfeiture provision. So we have talked with the city and the realtors, and we are not aware of any opposition to this bill. So I want to thank you, Mr. Chair, and I have staff from my property tax division here if there are any questions. And Mr. Chair, I have one correction that I need to correct in the language of the bill. On line 1.11, it states that taxes payable year 2021 or later. And it should be 2023, and I was hoping that maybe you can do an oral amendment to the bill, or we'll have to come back with later. Is that possible?
Yeah, this is going to be laid over, so we'll fix it in the big taxes.
Okay, beautiful.
Thank you. Is there anyone else that would like to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, member discussion? Oh, did you want to testify? Please. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair and member of the community, I would like to thank you for the opportunity and also the sponsors of this bill and the community members who pushed through this. And my name is Mohammed Liban. I'm a member of the St. Paul community, Frogtown neighborhood. And I'm proud to be next to my commissioner here in Ramsey, Frogtown. And my name is Mohammed. I'm impacted by this law, state law, because if you don't pay your taxes within 1 year, your property will be tax forfeited. And it's really horrible because a lot of community members don't know the law. And it's very easy to lose properties, and a lot of people lost homes in this community. So this law is coming over from 2008, and it impacted a lot of community who lost their homes in this community. And now the same law is affecting them because it's an expedited tax forfeiture that no other communities are facing. So I would like to and ask for this change. And it's not easy to change because it's state law. And our commissioners can do nothing about it. Our mayor can do nothing about it. Our commissioners, city council members, it's only up to the you guys. Thank you for your service.
Thank you. Anyone else that would like to testify for or against? Member discussion? Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe nonpartisan can help me with this, just a little background. Is this, or perhaps the bill author and or commissioner can help me as well. Is this non-residential property that we're talking about?
Mr. Swanson?
Or should I let me clarify that. Non-owner occupied residential homestead non-owner property.
Okay.
Mr. Chair and Representative O'Driscoll, so this sort of, you know, accelerated period of redemption in targeted communities applies only to non-homestead property. So, you know, it would be, a residential that's a residential property that's homesteaded would not be sort of subject to this accelerated redemption period.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Because under Minnesota law, you're allowed a five-year statutory, or I should say a five-year delinquency redemption on owner-occupied homestead properties, and all their properties are 3 years. And if these are still residential, but they're non-homestead, in other words, it might be an apartment or a rental facility, that would be under the three-year. My understanding is that was reduced from the three-year threshold down to 1 year. Now we're trying to move it back in consistency with statute for other non-residential property delinquencies and redemptions.
Mr. Swanson.
Mr. Chair and Representative O'Driscoll, so this, the change in this bill really only impacts non-homestead properties because this accelerated redemption was only applied to non-homestead properties. I hope I'm understanding your question correctly. If not, maybe you could restate it.
Representative Lee?
We do.
Representative Lee?
Representative O'Driscoll. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to just clarify. This is something that I started with earlier. Yes, so in Ramsey County, there are other properties that are homesteaded that do have the three-year redemption period, but there are other properties that are not homesteaded that are limited to 1 year, and so we're just bringing it back up to three so that there's uniformity across the county.
Representative Driscoll.
So now I'm a little bit more confused, and maybe the bill author misspoke when she said there's three-year homestead. It's a five-year under Minnesota law. Has Ramsey County had the law changed so that they're at a three-year redemption and a one-year redemption where the other 86 counties are at the statutory five and three on those? I'm confused.
Commissioner?
I think there are technical staff in the county here who can help answer that question.
Is there anyone from the county that could come address the question? And while they're coming up, I do want to note that Mr. Swanson is filling in, doing the Lord's work there. Please state your name for the record.
Nicholas Hansen with Ramsey County Property Tax Records and Election Services, Productive Properties, formerly Tax Forfeited Land. Team. As it is, just consulted with my colleagues as well, we will need to get back to you on this question.
Thank you. Ms. Schill.
Mr. Chair and members, long ago I worked with economic development and this kind of thing, and I will draw your attention to this section of law, section 469.201 is specifically for targeted community revitalization. And that is the section of code that is outlined for this particular exception where it went from 3 years to 1 year for the forfeiture. And I did a little reach back. Most cities across the nation at the time that this was put in place did so to obtain federal monies through the UDAG, Urban Development Action Grant Program, that was put in place in 1979. And so many cities did this and to gain access to these federal funds. And so part of the revitalization there was to quickly identify how they could revitalize certain sections of cities. And cities wanted the money for the revitalization, and so they followed the lead of the federal government. The bottom line is to do this and to do this quickly, the timeline from 3 years to 1 year was really part of that equation. That was a long time ago. And as I heard the testimony, times have changed. The city of St. Paul has reversed its course, recognizing a shift in perspective and targeting what they need to do, and therefore that's why they're coming forward with this. I hope that sheds some light on your question and why now the request is to go from 1 year to 3 years for the tax forfeiture.
Representative Lee?
And I want to clarify, I think Representative Odishko is correct that homesteaded land has the 5 year time period, but this is for not homes, land that's not homesteaded. So maybe that's where the confusion is, and that's why it's a 3 year redemption period.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Yeah, and the discussion is helping, I think, clarify for me and for others. And so Minnesota would have a owner-occupied homestead threshold of 5 years. Non-owner-occupied is 3 years. Because of the special provisions in law and redevelopment, it was reduced to 1 year, which I understand why you'd want to do that. And now we're moving it back from a 1 year to a 3 year standard, which in essence would be in keeping with what Minnesota statute is right now with the 5 and 3 year. Even though it's residential, non-owner-occupied homestead, and I realize there's a lot of moving parts in what I just talked about, but for whatever it's worth, I now have clarity, and that's all I'm concerned about right now from my perspective to know what we're doing with this particular bill. So I thank everybody for the indulgence.
Thank you. Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Chair Lislegarde, and thank you, Representative Lee, for bringing this forward, and former Representative Commissioner Moran. I was wondering if you could describe to us where the urban revitalization zones in Ramsey County are.
Representative Lee.
As we heard from the testifier, it's in low-income areas of St. Paul, like Frogtown, and Rondo, and I defer to our county staff if they have other things to add.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there is a 2010 map that does outline the census tracts where these targeted communities lie. I do not have that with me at the moment, but that could be provided later as well.
Representative Hollins.
Mr. Chair, I would say that throughout St. Paul, it will be in areas that they consider to have higher unemployment, lower medium household income areas. But there were some specific targeting that was done.
Thank you. Any follow-up, Representative Hollins?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that, and I suspect that part of my district would be counted in that zone. It's hard. I wouldn't want to assume what the legislators were doing in 2008, but it's hard to not look at this as a continuation of segregation and disenfranchisement for communities of color and low-income communities when we're saying that you have a one-year period to pay off these, when you're already economically disadvantaged and you have 1 year to pay off back owed taxes as opposed to 3 years for people who are not economically disadvantaged. And for that reason, I am heartily in support of this bill, and I want to thank the representative for bringing it. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And in order to avoid missing it, I guess I would make the motion that we amend on line 1.11, delete the one and replace it with the three, and that way we don't have to worry about catching it if it is included in a major bill because it gets busy during the omnibus season.
Thank you, but I thank you, Representative Quam, but I think that what we'll do is we'll lay this bill over for possible inclusion, and then I have full faith in the property, or not the property, well, I guess I got faith in myself too, but Chair Gomez to make sure if it's included that that's addressed.
And Mr. Chair, the other thing is during that layover period, can we make sure there aren't any other little areas where some other place has a change? I just want to make sure if we're going to change it for this one specific, right, which was because of something that happened decades ago, that we sort of look and see if there are similar pockets of aberrations to this, and then if we do it, we do it in more consistent and universal to get rid of confusion as we saw an example when we were trying to explain it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just, you know, with Representative Hollins asking her question or making her statement kind of got me to thinking. I was assuming that this was, since it was non-owner-occupied residential property, that that was happening is the owners of those were not paying taxes, which would cause those properties to be in arrears, and individuals would end up being displaced as a result of that. The individuals are not the owners of this property. They would have lost their ability to occupy the property after 1 year, which now delays that for a three-year period of time. And I, again, can't speak for why the legislature might have done that, but it may have been also to be able to do revitalization, as was suggested, to be able to bring safe and other housing that's maybe more up to code and habitable in a shorter period of time for folks who are otherwise displaced. I can't speak to that. That's the thought process I was going through when I heard the background on the bill.
Thank you. Anyone else? Closing comments.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just close by saying there were a lot of misguided policies that were enacted in the late 80s, and you know, we have the opportunity to correct them today. And so I hope that House File 2495 will be included in the division report. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Lee renews her motion that House File 2495 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Property Tax Division report. House File 2495 is laid over for possible inclusion. So I got to get that little stick. All right. Next up, we have House File 1342, Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So House File 1342 would give permissive authority.
Would you like to move your bill?
Oh, I would like to move my bill. Are we going to lay this over as well?
Correct. Okay. Yep.
Move to lay this over all for right. Potential inclusion.
Representative Elkins moves that House File 1342 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Property Tax Division report.
This vacant
And I believe that you have a video.
Yep, we're going to keep the presentation short. Just very briefly, the bill provides a permissive authority for cities to establish land value tax districts within their borders.
Okay.
We envision that a city would do this in a revitalization area. I think of an area like Lake Street, where a lot of the properties were burned out, where a city is concerned that speculators will just sit on the land. And as this video will explain, this is a tool to discourage speculation and encourage development.
Thank you.
Parcel of land in Austin, Texas might not look like much, but it offers a glimpse into how a skewed property tax system is worsening the housing crisis in America's biggest cities. The lot has an annual property tax bill of about $1.5 million per acre. But just six blocks over, this luxury apartment building is taxed at nearly double that rate. Cities all over the country are littered with empty or sparsely built sites. Some economists say they share a common factor, a tax system that combines low taxes on land with high taxes on buildings. Here's a closer look at that system and the often overlooked role it plays in the country's housing shortage. To understand the tax system, let's head back to 701 Trinity Street. Located near the heart of downtown Austin, the 0.2-acre parcel is valued at over $13.7 million. Yet for decades, the lot has only been used for parking, and the owners have paid relatively little in taxes because it doesn't contain any buildings. Cielo Property Group owns the vacant plot of land. They did not respond to a request for comment.
So traditional property taxes, perversely, disincentivize the kind of land use that we want to see in our cities. When you're taxing improvements, you're signaling to the market that you don't want improvements.
Josephine Foss is the executive director of the Robert Schockenbach Foundation, a nonprofit research organization that advocates for property tax reform.
So they actually affect the way that people use land or choose not to use land, which is something that might not initially be, you know, obvious thinking about property taxes.
When landowners improve their property by adding a new room, for instance, their taxes go up. In some cases, these taxes can be as much as 7 times higher for a developed piece of land compared to an empty lot.
The basic premise of property taxes in America is very simple. It's basically the government will try to figure out how much is a piece of real estate worth, and then based on that value, you'll be taxed. The more valuable your real estate is, the higher your tax.
presumably, the owners of more expensive buildings would be able to afford more expensive rates. But some economists say the system has an unintended consequence.
It makes it easy for people to take out properties and then just hold them until the value increases, sell at a profit, right? So the buy low, sell high, but without doing anything in the interim, including building housing.
Over the last few years, Texas home prices have skyrocketed. In January, Austin's median home price was $525,000, according to the Austin Board of Realtors. That's a 36% jump from January 2020.
So housing shortages have always existed in cities like New York and San Francisco. What's really changed in the last couple of years is that you're seeing more of this issue in places in the Sun Belt. I think Austin's really the textbook case of the booming Sun Belt city that's now running into all these housing shortage problems, because it used to be an affordable place, and now it's really one of the most expensive places in the South.
But despite rising demand for housing, developers struggle to find sites to build on.
Developers, paradoxically, are having a hard time finding land, but even those lots where law does allow you to build, often people just don't want to sell.
Austin alone has more than 17,500 vacant lots zoned for residential use, according to Altus Group, a real estate analytics firm. In Atlanta, Georgia, there's more than 13,000. And New York City has more than 77,000 lots that are vacant or less than half the size of what zoning allows. That's a lot of untapped potential. If the owners of all the vacant lots in Austin developed buildings to match the current density of the city, they could add over 1 billion square feet of housing, according to an Altus Group estimate. That's equivalent to about 384 Empire State Buildings, or over 800,000 additional apartment units.
So it's really adding to this issue of affordable housing or housing accessibility.
One solution proposed by lawmakers comes in the form of a land value tax. This places a higher tax rate on land while reducing taxes on buildings. In theory, this system would reduce the profit that comes from owning a vacant piece of property.
So if your tax code is set up that you can make money by improving the land that you've just been sitting on or selling it to somebody who will, that's what's going to happen.
Research suggests this type of taxing system has increased building activity in cities like Pittsburgh.
A couple of studies have actually shown that they had more construction activity in Pittsburgh relative to other nearby and similar cities that didn't have this sort of tax system.
Still, fairly assessing the value of land for taxation can be difficult. Some economists say it's simpler to assess improvements based on their income-producing ability. There are also political hurdles to implementing a new tax system.
One of the big challenges in America is that often, under state law, cities and counties can't decide on their own tax system. They basically have to defer to the state.
When it comes to building more housing, some developers say a land value tax may only make a small difference. Factors like restrictive zoning laws and rising material costs also play a role in delaying construction projects. Despite the challenges, one city, Detroit, may soon implement a land value tax. If approved, lawmakers and housing advocates say this could be a crucial test case for the tax policy.
Detroit would be the biggest city in the history of America to implement a land value tax. And it'd be a fascinating test case on whether this actually works in the 21st century and whether others will follow suit. If it works out, it could really change the way Americans think about property taxes.
There you have it. Questions?
Well, nicely done. I do believe we have a testifier. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Lislegaard and members. My name is Rich Nymoen. I am president of the Minnesota Chapter of Common Ground USA, which is an all-volunteer organization with 7 chapters throughout the U.S. Among other things, we promote land value tax shifts, as you saw in the video today. I'd like to share some examples of how this approach could be used in tax districts, which this bill would enable Minnesota cities to create. You should have a PowerPoint that I'm going to walk through with you. So slide 2, it shows that for under this bill, as an example, a city could put the entire city into one of these districts and have no tax on the building value at all. Slide 3 shows that if Walker, Minnesota were to do this, with these 2 example properties, it shows how this would be impacted. The nursing home building on the left would go from paying about $16,500 in total property taxes. That's for all jurisdictions. City, county, school district, and so on. They would go from paying that to paying about $6,500. The vacant lot on the right would go from paying about $800 to about $1,400, so almost doubling what they would pay. So that creates an incentive for holders of vacant and underused lots to put them to better use. Meanwhile, it makes it easier for above average uses to operate, such as the nursing home. Slide four shows that the bill also allows cities to use it in only certain neighborhoods or corridors, such as University Avenue between Rice and Snelling. This slide shows that the same amount of revenue that is raised by the conventional property tax in this corridor could be raised by a 5.9% rate on the corridor's land value. On slide five, at the bottom of the slide, there's a box that shows that the same amount of revenue could also be raised by what's called a split rate tax that has, in this example, a 10-to-1 split of a 5.7% rate on the property's land value and a 0.57% rate on the building value. Slide six shows some example properties, and on slide seven, it shows you that for the parking lot, it would go from paying currently about $4,600 and then to about $5,900 under the 10-to-1 split rate and to a about $6,100 under just taxing the land value. The bank building, meanwhile, would go from paying about $180,000 under the conventional approach to paying $102,000 under the 10-to-1 split, or about $91,500 if only its land value is taxed. So again, an incentive is created to put sites to better use. Slide 8 talks about some of the details of the bill. So it authorizes cities to create these districts by passing an ordinance where they would identify either a specific geographic area or specific parcels that would be in the district. The city would have to calculate how much revenue would be collected under conventional property tax system in the district, and then set out how that same amount of revenue would be raised using higher rates on land values. There's some notice requirements in the bill, and then after 15 years, the city must evaluate the impact of the district on redevelopment and investment. On the last slide, I would like to emphasize the last two items on that slide, which is that typically a majority of residents see a tax reduction if this is applied citywide. And finally, it is a way to capture community creative value, because land value is generated by a community's increased population and wealth, and by public investments in infrastructure, schools, fire and public safety services, and so on. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to testify for or against? Seeing none. Okay. Got the guy in the back row coming on down. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Eric Sorum. I'm a resident of Minneapolis. And today I brought a property tax statement. And one thing that I read on here is estimated market value. Over the course of a year, it says here that my home increased in value by $19,000. My question is, where did that money come from? I didn't earn it. I didn't do anything to get that value. I can assure you my house is old. It is getting worse with age. It's decreasing in value with age. So where did this money come from? The value comes from the city itself. Everything that we do collectively makes the land increase in value. The value belongs to line cooks in every restaurant, teachers in every school, the arts organizations, the delivery drivers, everybody who makes the city a great place. This money doesn't belong to me. If there's anything in society that should be taxed, it is the land value, because that value already belongs to society. This bill could be the start of a widespread adoption of a land value tax by taxing land and returning that value to everyone who lives here. We could create a new era of prosperity where economic equality increases at the same rate as economic growth. And we would do all this simply by giving to everyone what belongs to them. And so I ask you to consider supporting this, not only here, but to champion this bill in this session. And And thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Anyone else? Not seeing anyone. Member discussion. Anyone? Representative Quam.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I thought someone else might speak. I thought land was already taxed. I know when I talked to all my farmers, and they've got land, the land is taxed. So this is amazing to me because the statements from the testifier table were, seemed to be indicating land wasn't taxed. Am I correct in understanding that our current property taxes actually tax land? Is that a correct statement?
I will turn it over to Jared Swanson, please.
Mr. Chair and Representative Quam, the value of a piece of property for property tax purposes includes both the value of the land and any improvements to that land, like structures or buildings.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now that we've confirmed that we actually do tax land and relative to the value of the land and whatever it's on it, now this bill is becoming a discussion of how can we motivate someone to do something with their land that we want them to do that they necessarily may not want to do? And the motivation is apparently to shift the property tax that's being collected on them from others because they're not doing what we want them to do. And I thought we were in a free country where we got to choose what to do with our property unless it was condemned. So I'm seeing this bill as a new form of slow bleed condemnation and forcing people to do something they don't want to do, but big government knows better and will go ahead and tell them, you shall develop this land or we're going to be squeezing you financially. And that the people that, well, they built this nice facility, we like them, so we're not going to tax them as much, even though their business and their activities and the cash flow are part of the reason why, they're paying the taxes they are, because that's the value. When you're in a business, cash flow and income and revenue, those are valuable things. And that affects the value of the building, the facilities, the whole entity, the location. So I would hope that we don't go forward with a decreasing of personal rights and a arbitrary decision of shifting and burdening people because they're not doing with their own property what some entity desires it.
Thank
so
you.
I'm against this.
Okay, thank you. Chair Gomez, did you?
Yeah, just a couple brief comments. So obviously this language is not imposing anything on our cities. It's permissive. It allows the establishment of these districts, should locals want to do so. But I just want you to think a little bit about a community like the one that I represent that was impacted by the civil unrest in Minneapolis. A lot of structures burned down. There's still, if you drive, I don't know, Representative Quam, I don't think you were able to make it out for any of the tours that we had back in 2020, but you can still drive down Lake Street and see the impact of what happened and that there are chunks of Lake Street, which is really sort of the main street in my district. It's the equivalent of that. It's sort of the commercial district where I live. And there are a lot of a lot of empty lots still there, and a lot of the landscape tells this story about what happened in our community, even years later. And ours is not the only district that tells a story like that when you drive down Main Street. And I understand you're kind of like talking about, well, this infringes on someone's like sacred property rights. Well, guess what? We infringe on people's sacred property rights in government all the time in like many, many ways. And the reality is that like what happens on somebody's lot that they own doesn't just impact them. It impacts the entire community that property is situated in. And what happens when we live in proximity to each other, when we live in community with each other, is that we are connected in a number of ways. Like there's these webs of interconnection that happens when you share a geography with each other. That's why we all talk about our cities and our towns and our communities and where we're from. And so I guess, a giant corporate landowner from out of state buying up a parcel on East Lake Street, which has been impacted by the civil unrest. And so there's sort of like a thing that happens when there is that kind of destruction in an area where you could buy a parcel and just sit on it for 5 years, for 10 years, until your personal calculation about how you can maximize your personal wealth gets to the point where you want to do it. But where it's advantageous to you personally to sell that land. But we do things to encourage people to do stuff with their land or their personal property all the time in government. And I guess I just would say that, this is just a tool to encourage the kind, to discourage blight, which is something that we deal with in our statutes, right? To encourage development, which is something that we do in our statutes all the time, to encourage positive benefits to the surrounding community, because we're actually connected to each other when we're in physical proximity to one another. The roads that our taxes pay for serve that property, even if it's just sitting there getting dusty, not providing any value to the community, but providing value to somebody who's decided that it's in their personal interest to do something that is not in the interest of the community that they've chosen to buy a piece of property in. So, I appreciate us having this conversation and bringing this bill forward. I think that it's, I have questions about it too. Elkins and I have had a lot of conversations and we'll continue to do that, because I'm sort of the opinion that like, hey, if there are two pieces of property and one has like a really fancy thing on it and one has kind of a more modest thing on it, maybe the property with the really fancy thing on it should be more valuable, and it is an asset that somebody owns and it should be taxed at a higher rate. I think that in sort of the housing crisis particularly that we're in, we need to figure out what it is that we can do to make sure that that we're all acknowledging that relationship between landowners and people living in a community and people who own businesses in a community. Having a business next to a dusty, neglected, empty lot is really bad for that business. And like, that person has property rights too. And the house down the street has property rights too. So, it's sort of a balance, but I appreciate you bringing this forward.
Okay, thank you. Anyone else? I want to thank you, Chair Gomez. As always, you articulate and you put things in perspective, so thank you for doing that. Closing comments, Mr.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Commissioner. This doesn't result in a tax increase or tax decrease overall. All it's doing is apportioning the levy for an area of land according to the value of the land rather than the land plus the structure. And we have a shortage of developable land, especially for housing right now. If a speculator can sit on a property, a parcel of land, and pay the property taxes with surface parking, thinking that 10 years from now the land is going to appreciate considerably, then that's an economically advantageous thing for them to do under the current tax structure. So, I envision that cities would use this experimentally and to see what happens. happens, and then bring it forward in a more broad fashion. Most of the people who study this think that in the long run, what will really make sense is a split role taxation, where you would still tax both the property and the land, but you might tax the improvements at a lower rate than you do the land. What we're looking for is improving the efficiency with infrastructure issues. In an urban area, the land owes all of its value to the infrastructure that government provides. It would have no value if there were no streets, there were no sewers, there were no water. And this is a more effective way of taxing that capability, whether it's used or not, and encouraging it to be used. So thank you, Mr. Chair. And with that, I will renew my motion that we lay this over for possible consideration.
All right. Representative Elkins renews his motion that House File 1342 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Property Tax Division report. House File 1342 is laid over for possible inclusion. Okay. Next, we have House File 1535. Welcome, Representative Aiken. The chair moves that House File 1535 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Property Tax Division report. So to the bill author, welcome, and please present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Appreciate the opportunity to be with you today. For hearing House File 1535, which authorizes the City of Wayzata to impose a food and beverage tax. The City of Wayzata has a small population of approximately 4,300 residents, yet hosts a large amount of visitors from across the region and the state. If you have been to Wayzata, you know it's a beautiful small town that provides public access to Lake Minnetonka for Minnesotans. Year-round, whether boating, dining in our many bars and restaurants, biking along the trails, or enjoying Wayzata's chilly open on the ice, Wayzata is full of visitors. The city is seeking your authority to impose a local food and beverage tax to assist the city in its stewardship of their public amenities that the thousands of visitors enjoy. And Mr. Chair, with your permission, we can turn it over to our testifiers.
Thank you, Representative Aiken. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Representative Aikom and committee members and chair, I'm Jeff Parkhill. I serve as one of the Wayzata City Council members. I am joined today by our City Manager and Deputy City Manager. Thank you so much for allowing the City of Wayzata to testify today. Our request is for a 1% food and beverage tax. As some background on Wayzata, we are a small suburban community of less than 5,000 people, 4,400 to be more precise. It has grown as a significant regional destination for employment, recreation, shopping, and dining. Being a regional destination means that our population size is not indicative of the amount of people that come to our community each day. Employment alone more than doubles our daily population. We have a vibrant restaurant scene that brings a lot, and I mean a lot, of people to our community, which is a good thing. In fact, about 90% of the restaurant patrons are non-residents. Our understanding is that this is the highest ratio in the state. Deputy City Manager Aurora Yeager, representing our city, is going to provide a little more context about the request and its benefits.
Welcome, Aurora. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. My name is Aurora Yeager, and I'm the Deputy City Manager. So I just want to build off of some of the comments that our Council Member Parkhill made to talk more about the need for this sales tax. So Wayzata currently receives no local government aid or municipal state aid, and we also contribute just under 10% of our tax capacity to the Fiscal Disparities Program. So despite the fact that we're, you know, contributing a lot of our tax base outside of the community, we have a lot of people who are non-residents coming into our community. And they're, you know, placing a growing burden on the need to provide additional services, upkeep our amenities, and things like that. But visitors don't pay rent to occupy buildings in the city. They don't pay property taxes. And so our residents are currently paying for that independently. So that's what led us to this ask for the food and beverage sales tax. That would help us fund significant investments in public safety operations, park maintenance, and capital improvements that are enjoyed by all of our regional visitors. These uses from the sales tax really support both the needs of visitors, our community, and our businesses as well. And this type of tax is one of the few ways the city can, you know, capture revenue from people who aren't property owners. So, but as a more specialized type of sales tax, it would not apply to essential items. It only applies to those prepared food and beverages. And we feel like that's a good balance between trying to mitigate some of the strain that visitors have on our community without being too burdensome, or especially to those on fixed incomes. So while food and beverage taxes themselves are not super prevalent, there are several communities that have them. Specifically, many of the places that Wayzata competes with for dining experiences, notably Minneapolis, St. Paul, those have them. Along with a neighboring city in Excelsior also has a local option sales tax, so that applies to the restaurants in their community. So actually, as a regional destination, we're unique in that we don't have some kind of local sales tax to help us diversify our revenue sources. So the city of Wayzata is therefore, you know, asking for this ability to utilize this tool like many other regional destinations already use to improve and maintain our regional amenities. I believe our city manager, Jeffrey Dahl, has one more item to add about the public process.
Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
I think it's good morning still, close. Good morning, Chair. Thank you, and committee members. My name is Jeffrey Dahl. I'm the city manager for the city of Wayzata. I'll be real brief. I just want to talk a little bit about transparency in our public engagement. We know that anytime a tax is being considered, there's going to be people and groups that are upset, and probably for good reason. We started engaging with key stakeholders, including our local Chamber of Commerce, prior to initiating this request and before the council approved it in a public hearing. We will continue to engage the restaurants in our community to ensure their viability. We want them to sustain themselves and be vibrant and be successful. We've already begun that process. We've got some good plans, and I look forward to working with them on coming up with some solutions to utilize some of that revenue to help themselves to ensure their sustainability as well. So with that, I think you have a one-pager kind of summary of the request and why. We're certainly available to answer any questions that you may have. Thank you, Representative Acomb, and thank you, Chair, for hearing us today.
Thank you. Is there anyone else that would like to testify? Okay, please come to the testifying table, state your name for the record, and proceed.
Chair. Good afternoon, members. My name is Laura Garcia, and I am the general manager of the Hotel Landing and 925 restaurant in Wayzata. I'm here today to share my concerns with this House File 1535, which would allow this food and beverage tax. I'm concerned about the unintended consequences that a policy like this can bring to the community and to the hospitality businesses. As I'm sure you know, the last 2 years have had a tremendous impact on our businesses. And coupled with the already increased cost of goods, the supply chain issues, increased labor, this additional financial burden will bring challenges to the hospitality businesses. Additionally, the potential passage of earned safe and sick time legislation, as well as paid family medical leave, will put our businesses in a situation where we need to evaluate how to bear the cost while balancing pricing to our customers. We have worked very hard to rehire our staff and to retain them and to build a culture where we want to keep these employees. And the last thing we want to do is potentially put these employees at risk by having to potentially cut jobs to pay for this additional tax. In addition, a tax that singles out one industry is just wrong. While the hospitality industry is recovering, our businesses and our employees took significant hits in the pandemic in the form of revenue and income loss. We should look at the budget needs of the city as an entire community, with all of the businesses sharing the vision as well as the burden. If resources are needed to attract, maintain, and protect Wayzata assets, all the businesses will benefit and they all should contribute. So before this bill moves forward, I think it's prudent that elected and city officials sit down with the businesses to discuss the funding needs of the city as well as other options before moving forward. We should not target a single industry or set precedent by establishing a food and beverage tax in our area. Thank you for listening.
Thank you. Anyone else that would like to testify on this bill? Seeing none, member discussion. Representative Hewitt.
Real quickly, Mr. Chair, and to the city manager, what is your public safety budget?
Mr. Chair, committee members, our public safety budget is about $2 million.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and that's pretty hard to do as you're not getting any LGA, you're having trouble with recruitment and retention, you have a volunteer fire service, and you have the call for service continuing to grow. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. Anyone else? Lead Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What the neighboring cities, you know, Plymouth, Minnetonka, Orono, Woodland, you know, how many of these neighboring cities have the, you know, 1% food and beverage tax?
Mr. Dahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee member. Food and beverage is unique to Wayzata in the West Metro, but Plymouth has a lodging tax, Excelsior has the local option sales tax, and some of those other communities that you mentioned, Woodland, et cetera, they don't have a commercial district like we do.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We used to, when I was young, go on trips on the weekends and go places, and I did notice that there were times where we would stop for lunch or, you know, grab some stuff, not where we were going, but because it was more economical to use one of the ones on the way. And because the city's not in a vacuum, the fact that restaurants tend to be a difficult enterprise, I think there's a huge percent that don't last more than a 1, 2, 3 years, you know, a short period of time. I would think that maybe you would look at broader, because you don't get anything if you cause a competitive disadvantage and now your restaurant's closed. A lodging tax, they might have a restaurant in there, but they're not having the extra tax on the meal. A lodging tax isn't comparable. So if in your region you don't have that, it might be prudent to look at things that would be less disadvantaged. You know, it wouldn't be a disadvantage to your local businesses, because losing them, I think, is going to be a bigger risk than the money you're going to gain. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else? Not seeing anyone. Before I go to Representative Akam for closing comments, I would just like to say that regarding the one testifier about going to the city, you are one of the most all-inclusive, bringing people to the table to have a discussion when you're formulating, you know, bringing something forward. So I always admired that about you and your approach to be thoughtful, methodical as you bring things. So with that, closing comments.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the committee's time today, and I do appreciate the City of Wayzata's efforts to engage with the restaurant and bar community. So I appreciate the time, and I hope you consider it a part of your omnibus bill. Thank you.
Thank you. The Chair renews his motion that House File 1535 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Property Tax Division Report. House File 1535 is laid over for possible inclusion in the Property Tax Division Report. Okay, we are adjourned, but we do have a meeting tomorrow night at 6 p.m. in room 10 or 15 minutes after session. You're excited about that, aren't you? I can see it.
Sure.
I can see how excited you are.
No,
tomorrow.
Tomorrow night?
Tomorrow night after session, 15 minutes after session, or 6 p.m. All right?
Mr. Chair,
all right.
I have a root canal.
We all, well, it feels like it sometimes, doesn't it? All right, we are adjourned.